Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Terry Rowland, and I am your hostess for this evening for this Thursday, August 1st edition of Patriot Education. As always, we are brought to you through the good offices of a great group of people who really know and understand and believe that we are the nation. That's the folks at www.patriotfamilies.com. Please join us every night of the week for our radio shows and visit our website, ladies and gentlemen, where you'll find dedicated people, people who believe in the fundamental principles our founding fathers used to create this extraordinary nation in which we live. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is teacher tenure, plus or minus. For those of you who may or who may not know what tenure involves, originally tenure was put in place in colleges and universities to guarantee that professors who were taking time off from actually teaching classes to write something that was going to be published and therefore give them more stature in the academic world needed to be able to be assured that their job would be there for them when they had completed their monograph, their book, whatever, their study, their doctoral thesis. So tenure was put in place in the sense that they had taught long enough and were productive enough as teachers that their job was secure and they could take the time off to do the writing that they needed in the publish or perish universe of academia and still have a job that gave them a regular stipend during that time if they took a sabbatical and to which they could return when they were finished. Well, the idea of tenure, the idea of job security, of a guaranteed position that you have earned by good performance over a period of years, then trickled down through the offices of the teachers' unions to our public schools, from high school all the way down through elementary and primary. It was intended to be a benefit or a carrot to pull people into the profession of teaching, because teachers' wages and teachers' reputations were pretty low. Partly because in the schools, prior to the widespread implementation of public schools, were often staffed by people who literally could do nothing else because for whatever reason, either psychological or addiction or personality, they couldn't hold a job in anything else. They may have been less than abstemious when it came to liquor, or they might have had financial troubles, or they might have been young and hadn't established a reputation in the workforce. But it was understood, particularly by the teachers, that their profession was one of the most important ones in society. They were being asked to create educated citizens. They were being paid poorly at the time to create the future, if you will. And so, in order to induce them to continue to work for less than the average pay of an equivalently educated person in the public sector, tenure was considered to be a good incentive. Unfortunately, like many incentives, like many benefits, it became considered a right rather than a privilege. And it became an excuse to continue to employ people who were not doing their job well, simply because they had managed to do it reasonably well for 5 years or 10 years or however many years that particular school system needed you to invest before you had tenure. Well, recently the state of North Carolina state legislature has passed legislation that pretty much effectively eliminates the idea of tenure in public schools. There was a discussion among some teacher friends of mine on Facebook, to which I would have liked to contribute, but my computer locked up in the middle of trying to type a response, so I never did get to say it there, about the pros and cons. And I understand both sides of the question. I understand the teacher's desire to have job security. That has been something that all of us have wanted. It used to be obtainable, but unfortunately, in these days of a rapidly changing workforce and technology, the 25 years in the gold watch prognosis doesn't exist anymore. Very few people remain with the same firm or the same company for an entire lifetime of work experience, unless, of course, they create the company and stay with it until it becomes wildly successful and then either retire or sell it or pass it on to their children or whatever. But the old idea of staying with the same company and putting in your 20 years or your 25 years and retiring with a party and a gold watch or a fancy gold pen set, people sort of expected that, and it was encouraged. The idea that if you did a good job, eventually you would be rewarded for it. You would have seniority. You would be the elder statesman in your workplace. And it was an inducement to stay with a job that might not have given you the same flash of passion and interest as it did the first year, but that comfortable retirement, that sense of having been important for that length of time, did look like a good deal. And many people, even now, would like that to be the way of the world. But as much as we would like to have the world work that way, it doesn't anymore. I don't know of any other profession that even assumes they could offer such a firm commitment to keeping one's job, regardless of any consideration other than the length of time one has done it. I don't know of any industry or any private sector form of employment that basically guarantees you the sure position for your entire working life. Yet, I understand that teachers believe, many teachers believe, that tenure is something that they have earned by doing a very difficult job and doing it well and to the best of their ability and with passion and dedication. And that because their salaries and their compensation is usually well below the average of those in the private sector, this benefit is important to them because it makes them feel that their services have value. We've apparently got some issues tonight, ladies and gentlemen, with Blog Talk Radio. Apparently there's a problem with the description of tonight's topic, and I really don't know what the problem is other than the fact that they have, according to Blog Talk Radio, an entirely different subject than I'm talking about tonight. But I'm sorry if anybody has called in or anybody has dropped into the chat room and aren't hearing the people that they say are going to be on my show. I promise you, I had absolutely nothing to do with that because my topics are always posted on Facebook and on the Patriot Family website, and they go out by email to our family members. So hopefully we'll be able to get that straightened out. But anyway, back to tenure. The downside of tenure is that, unfortunately, it has been used to keep teachers who really are not doing their job well in a position of power to retain their job and thus not educate the children whose responsibility they are. The North Carolina legislation, as I understand it, and I only got a brief glimpse at it, I have not actually read the law, but the interpretation that I saw indicated that tenure, as you've got your job forever so long as you've worked for us for 5 years or whatever, that is no longer the case. Now teachers will be evaluated on their performance, and their scores on that evaluation will decide whether they're offered a one-year, two-year, three-year, or four-year contract based on an evaluation. Now, in a way, on one side of the scale, this is a good thing because it eliminates the possibility of a teacher who is not competent continuing to pretty much do nothing to educate kids for 20 years or so. But on the downside, what exactly are you evaluating when you decide whether or not a teacher is qualified or competent? Do you evaluate on the number of students in that teacher's classroom who pass the course? Do you evaluate on what the principal sees when he or she sits in the back of the classroom and watches once every month or so? Do you evaluate on the opinions and comments of the students with regard to the teacher and the teacher's methods and what they've learned? Do you evaluate based on what the parents think of the teacher? Do you evaluate on what these principal and assistant principal think of the teacher? Do you evaluate on what the school board thinks of the teacher? The problem that we face with tenure as a plus or a minus is the same problem we face with any merit-based system of dealing with those educators in our public schools. For those of you who have never taught in school, this is going to sound as if I am pro-teacher and all teachers are wonderful and everybody hates us, but they're all evil and they just don't understand. And I hope I don't come across that way because that's not what I'm saying. But having been involved with education, both in the private sector as a professional tutor and in the public schools, over the last 25 years or so, teachers have been told that they have to be Superman and Superwoman. They must somehow by sheer superhuman powers, put knowledge into the heads of a classroom full of children, half of whom don't want to be there, or are ill-prepared, or have been passed to the next grade with no mastery of the previous grade skills, or whose parents are indifferent to their progress and refuse to even answer the phone if the teacher calls, and half the other half of the class wants to learn things, but out of that half, some learn better from visual, some learn better by listening, some are, like me, give them a textbook or a manual and they can figure it out. My friend Linda says, oh, by the Vulcan mind meld or Merlin's magic wand, and she's quite right. Somehow or other, teachers are expected to have access to either one of those tools. And if they do not make a classroom of 30 children, all straight-A students with complete mastery of every skill in their discipline, they are seen as less than competent. The whole controversy over tenure, over public school teachers' pay, over their benefits, over teachers' unions, over we're all about the kids, the child-centered classroom, every bit of it comes right back to the progressive desire to think of human beings as cogs in machinery. You can evaluate performance, ladies and gentlemen, of many professions. If you are a doctor and all of your patients die after following the regimen of medical care that you've given them, it's pretty clear you're not a very competent doctor. If you're a machinist and all of the parts in the generator that you build don't mesh properly so that every generator you work on falls apart the first time somebody tries to use it, you're not a competent machinist. If you are a jeweler, and every time you resize a ring, you get it so thin or so thick it doesn't fit the owner anymore, and breaks if you look at it, or it's so heavy that they can't wear it for fear they're going to get a sprained shoulder, you're not a very good jeweler. If you're a banker, and your bank owes more money to its depositors than it has on hand when the depositors come in and ask for their money, you're not really a very good banker. We are used to being able to look at those who provide goods and services for us and evaluate them on the effectiveness with which they do their job based on the service we purchase and its effectiveness, or the product we purchase and its effectiveness. But with teachers, that method is almost impossible to use because the value and effectiveness of the teacher's job isn't demonstrated until long after the student has left his or her classroom. If you have to wait 10 years or so to find out whether or not a teacher is competent, it kind of makes it difficult to evaluate them on a yearly basis, especially for the first 10 years they've been in the classroom. It isn't the report card, ladies and gentlemen, or the standardized test scores, which the progressives want in their data-driven mentality to use as the sole criteria for the measurement of the competence of teachers and the progress of students. Because test scores and report cards do not always tell the truth. I've given examples before on this program of test scores and report cards that definitely did not tell the truth. And I know that my experience of these things is not standing alone and is not unique. And if I were to work in every single public school system in this nation, I would find other instances of both those things. because the effect of a good teacher does not just show up in memorization of facts, figures, and procedures, or in a pass or fail of a particular subject. The effect of a good teacher, which is very hard to measure, is engendering a desire and willingness to learn in his or her students. And because this is so difficult to measure or even see until that student has passed on to further academic achievement, evaluating teachers and their effectiveness is always a conundrum. Yes, we need to reward teachers who are good at what they do. And yes, we need to try to induce them to stay in the profession. But we also need to recognize when a teacher is not effective. There isn't any real mechanistic, data-driven, punch card way to do this, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately. And I hate to sound defeatist. My friend Linda says, how about the NSA? Well, all that lovely data collection. You know, if we track everything everybody does, we may be able to figure out who's good at something and who's not. But do you want to live in that kind of a world? I certainly don't. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be able to measure competence. We should. We want to know that our children are in good hands when we send them off to school in the morning. And we want to know that they have gained something by the time they come home from school in the afternoon. But the only way we will know that is if we talk with them and we look at what they're learning and we ask them what they learned and really listen to the answer and don't accept the nothing, which is the usual answer from if they're over the age of 12. We need to pay attention, ladies and gentlemen, to those phone calls and notes from the teachers. And we need to show up for conferences. And we need to learn that our children come through us, not of us. Because they're our precious little angel baby at home doesn't mean they're the precious little angel baby in a classroom with 20 to 25 other students all raising you know what the minute the teacher's back is turned. We want our children to get more than just, gee, I had fun today out of school. We'd like it if the I had fun today is part of what they get. But I think most of us with children and grandchildren want our kids to learn how to do things like read, keep a checkbook, understand contracts, know the history of the nation and some of the history of the world, be aware of certain scientific principles and methods, understand adults when they speak, have a vocabulary of more than 300 words, 10% of which are obscenities. These are what the basic needs that we look to our public schools to fulfill. But unless we pay attention, the evaluation of our teachers will be based on things that really don't prove anything about whether or not they're any good at what they do. I can tell you of so many students whose report cards look absolutely wonderful, all A's and B's, and yet they would no more be able to read a contract to buy an automobile than my cats can. And yet, these same students are going to be passed on all the way through 12 years of school, and they're going to be graduated from high school, and they're going to be going into the workforce with no skills. Unless they have somebody around to read everything they're supposed to do out of whatever employee manual they have and stand over them while they do it, they are not going to be able to hold a job or support themselves. And Lord knows they are prime fodder for quote-unquote predatory lenders and maxing out credit cards and bankrupting themselves or being pulled into the society of people who are just as stupid but are a lot more aggressive and violent than they are. And you're going to expect those report cards that they got to indicate that all their teachers were incredibly wonderful. Well, they may have been. But sometimes, no matter how wonderful you are, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Old saying, and like most old sayings, it got old because it's very apropos. And it fits. If we measure the effectiveness of our teachers based on grades and standardized testing alone, we are not going to get a clear picture of what teachers do in today's classrooms. Earlier in the program, I mentioned that teachers are expected to have superhuman powers. And I've mentioned this before, and I say it over and over again, ladies and gentlemen, because you have to understand what it is they're told they have to do. If you were in a job where somebody told you you had to do something that was impossible and fired you when you were unable to do it, you would be justifiably angry and would probably be going to through whatever legal pathway you could find to either get your job back or be compensated for the lack of a paycheck. And that this happens with teachers. In today's public school classrooms, teachers are expected to make sure that every student who has an individualized educational program, the infamous IEP, is accommodated according to that plan with whatever special conditions or equipment or behaviors or approaches or teaching styles necessary. And if they do not, they will lose their jobs. Because the IEP of a student is a binding contract with the school, backed by the federal government and the Department of Education. And if you do not abide by it, the parents of that child can and will sue you and win. And since very few public school systems would like to be sued, they will immediately get rid of any teacher who is not slavishly obedient to every teeny tiny statement in an IEP. My friend Linda says it's time we all revolt and grow some spine and stop complying, and she's quite correct. It's a very difficult thing, ladies and gentlemen, to put your livelihood on the line. And to stand up and say, this is wrong. And take the risk of being unable to pay your bills, your mortgage, take care of your children, and feed your family. It is very difficult to do. But unless we do it, or we pull out of the system altogether, we will continue to have the worst public education system in the developed world. And I'm sorry, but I believe right now we do have. And that doesn't mean that every public school in the country is bad. Some of them are very good. Most of the ones that are good are the ones that are not standing in line, well, getting down on all fours, wagging their tails with their mouths open in line for federal handouts. There aren't very many of those. One solution, of course, is the growing interest in homeschooling and online learning. The benefit to online learning is that the student can go at their own pace. And for some kids, this is very necessary. And I'm not talking just the special education students. I'm also talking to the very bright and the average kids. For me, everything in English was easy. I could read on an eighth grade level when I was in fourth grade. But math was a different story. I used to literally cry over the erasure holes in my paper when I was trying to learn how to do long division in fourth grade. So if I had the freedom that our kids have now with the internet and computers and so on and so forth to pursue education at my own pace, I would probably have been reading on a 12th grade level by fourth grade. And if I had had time to sit back and investigate and play with the long division, it might have come clear a little sooner. Once I figured out a way to estimate, from then on it was a breeze. But the way that the teacher was explaining estimation didn't make any sense to me, because her estimation process was different from the way that I saw numbers. My friend Bill says he watches Gunsmoke and Rawhide, and I agree with him. So do I. I grew up with Westerns, Bill, and I wish they'd come back of those types, because the Western is the quintessential dramatic presentation of basic American understanding and values. The man or woman who goes out and does what needs to be done, who stands up for what's right, who would rather not fight, but if it comes to fight or see injustice, fight is the answer. I've always loved Westerns, ladies and gentlemen. I wish more of our kids today had had the opportunity to learn the morality play lessons from the old ones. The idea that every individual had the opportunity to rise as high and go as far as his skills or abilities or talents would take him. Those values, too, are part of the reasons, one of the reasons, that our school system is falling apart. Educators today are expected to be everything and anything to their students. Surrogate parents, psychological counselors, spiritual gurus, playmates, babysitters, grandparents, good friends, buddies, BFFs. The teacher is supposed to be, oh, I don't know what to call it, some sort of incredibly amazing mother, father, coach, priest, godlike figure to every child in the classroom. The evaluating of the effect of education, ladies and gentlemen, is such a, I don't know what to call it. It's, as I mentioned before, it's a conundrum. Because it's about the only profession that I know of where the results of whether of your service, the value of it, doesn't show up until long after you have performed it. In a sense, the only other profession I can think of that comes close to that is the profession of a clergy person. As a teacher, as a spiritual teacher, your effectiveness lies in whether or not those you teach become good people. And you may not ever know whether they do or not. One of the reasons I always did have difficulty with the Protestant method of hiring and firing your minister, because it always seemed to me that if he said what you'd like to hear, it was okay and he could keep his job, but if he said something you didn't like, you could fire him, and it didn't matter whether what he said was true or not, it just mattered whether or not you liked it. I could be wrong, since I didn't go to a Protestant church, but it always kind of confused me a little bit. Growing up Catholic, whatever priest you had that priest. And I don't care how many times you complained to the archbishop or the bishop, you still had that priest. It did give a certain continuity to things, and that was definitely tenure. And believe me, nuns had tenure, life tenure, and most of them did teach until they were at the point they could no longer keep their eyes open long enough to do an hour's class. I remember one dear little old nun who used to sleep in the hallways in between the dormitory and the classroom at my college in Milwaukee. I went to a Catholic women's school. But the effectiveness of education, ladies and gentlemen, is not very easy to establish while a child is still in school. It is a process. It is a foundation for a future for that child. And whether or not it was effective doesn't really show up until that child is out of school and attempting to make its way in the real world. This difficulty in how to evaluate and how to ensure that we reward competent teachers and we don't keep incompetent ones has always been difficult. In the olden times, when the community hired the teacher for the one-room school, it was fairly easy to reconcile. If the majority of the community felt that their children were getting the kind of education they needed from that teacher, the teacher's job was fairly secure. If they didn't think the education their children were getting was secure, they would quite quickly fire the teacher. There were drawbacks to that system, in that if the teacher happened to be a relative of someone who had political power in the county or the city or the village or the town, their job was fairly secure until or unless they did something really bad, like set fire to a child in the middle of a class, or the person that was the power in the county robbed a bank and therefore toppled and took the teacher with them. But at least it was community-based. These days, the community doesn't often take any interest in what's going on in the school. About the only place where you see community involvement is in the more rural areas, because there everybody is either kin to everybody else or is married to somebody who is kin to everybody else or works with somebody who's kin to everybody else. So everything that goes on, everybody hears it. So if somebody's kid got treated badly by a teacher, it'll be all over the county or the town or the village and two heartbeats. And depending on whether or not somebody else's kid had a similar experience, the teacher will either be in the right and the kid's a perfect brat, or the teacher is a mean, horrible person and abusing all of the children every moment of every day. And again, the hearsay costs more people their livelihood than most people would realize, especially when it's hearsay coming from the mouths of kids. And that comes back to one of the factors that I mentioned earlier, the child-centered classroom. Originally, the idea of the child-centered classroom was supposed to mean that the classroom was there for the benefit of the children, and that the teacher's job was to ensure that that classroom was a good learning environment for every kid in it, which makes perfect sense. But, like most progressive ideas, the germ of it, which made good sense, blossomed into an incredibly poisoned tree. Instead of the classroom being a good learning environment for the children, it became the children controlled the classroom. Well, if you have ever been around 25 kids all at one time, you know that putting them in charge of anything except possibly eating marshmallows is a very, very bad idea. My friend Linda says, progressives sure know how to screw up everything, do they not? They do. As much as I don't want to sound like a quote-unquote racist, as Glenn was talking about, by saying they, meaning not my tribe, I do have a regrettable tendency to lump progressive liberals into the irremediably insane category, and I know that's bad of me, and I'm sure some of them are very nice to their dogs and pat little children on the head and, you know, leave a good tip at a restaurant, but I can't help thinking that my perception of their ability to think is fairly accurate. I know that's terrible of me, and I'm probably going to have a liberal, you know, burn something on my front lawn. Not a cross, of course, because they don't espouse that, but, oh, I don't know, maybe a... I know they'll probably come and burn the Obamacare 8,000 pages of legislation on my front lawn or something like that. That's okay. I have a hose, and I can quite easily put it out, so I'm not going to worry about it. But the whole child-centered classroom thing goes back to Dewey and his idea that education had to be hands-on. The idea that children learn better if they do something physical in the process, which is not psychologically inaccurate. It is quite accurate. Unfortunately, it is not the only way children learn, and it is not the only way they are going to be expected to learn when they become adults. And one of the functions of an education is to teach children to be lifelong learners. It is a set of skills and a body of knowledge from which they can grow adult understanding and competence. It is not a list of rules and regulations about where they can sleep, how much food they can eat, how much exercise they should have, 2 + 2 = 4, that they have to look everything up in before they get up in the morning to make sure that they're following exactly the right chores for each moment of the day. No, that's not what an education is for. The old rote method of memorizing things and standing up and repeating when you had absolutely no clue what they meant was just as wrong as the current method of, oh, well, I don't have to learn that, it's too hard, and, you know, I could text in my term paper, and, you know, I would still say what I thought, and that's the only thing that's important, you know, obviously. It's two extremes of the pendulum, ladies and gentlemen, and human beings are very good at the pendulum swing. The pendulum swing. We take a good idea and we push it to its extreme and find out that, wait a minute, it wasn't such a good idea after all. Unfortunately, and I say this out of compassion, many progressives and many liberals truly believe that all of these ideas will benefit mankind. I understand the desire to make the world better. I understand the desire to have all children productive and comfortable and happy throughout their lives. I can't think of a parent who would not want their children to be happy and productive and comfortable throughout their whole lives. but I also can't think of a parent who would willingly hand over their child to an entity that ensures that happy, productive comfort by eliminating the child's ability to make any choice whatsoever. The topic tonight of tenure being a plus or a minus is symptomatic of the ways we are trying to fix our broken education system. We're tinkering with a system that isn't working. We're trying to do spot fixes here and spot fixes there. And we are making the assumption that if we just make a new law, everything will be fine and nobody will ever do anything bad. The assumption being that if we make a law against something, obviously nobody is ever going to do it again. Which also is part of the irremediably insane tag that I have a tendency to put on most liberal progressives. And some conservatives as well. If we just outlaw it, nobody will do it. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. My friend Linda says broken washing machine syndrome. Yep, she's exactly right. Yep, if I've got a broken washing machine, I'm just keep pouring money in it, and obviously sooner or later it'll just be so happy to have all that cash in it, it'll just spontaneously start working again. And that's pretty much it. The idea that if something is fully funded, obviously, it's going to turn into a good idea, even if it was incredibly stupid to begin with. Head Start's a good example of that. We care about our children, ladies and gentlemen. All of us do. As a nation, we care about children. And in spite of all of the rhetoric from the left and all of the pictures of poor, starving babies and wherever they are, in general, this is the only country in the world that I know of, or in the history of the world, that has an obesity problem among the children of the poor. And yes, that shows that we're uncaring because those poor little children will have heart attacks and die. They might. But those poor little children, I'm sure, are not driving themselves to McDonald's. And I'm pretty sure that they are not earning the money to go there and buy six Big Macs and eat them all by themselves. Obviously, children come into this world as, I won't say blank slates, because they come equipped with a personality and a set of abilities, and a brain that functions in its own unique way, and a unique set of fingerprints, and facial features, and all the rest. They're not blank slates, but they are slates with decorations around the edges, waiting for the middle to be filled with knowledge. And we care about giving them knowledge. That's why we have supported, as a nation, the idea of public education, because it was an opportunity to gain knowledge for all children, rich or poor, no matter what demographic they came from. The public schools were considered to be a bastion of freedom because any child could learn. Any child could walk into the doors of public school, and all they had to do was listen and attend, and knowledge would be offered to them. But instead of that function, that understanding, that willingness to accept that not everybody is going to take what is offered, when that basic viewpoint of what education is and what it should be is lost in the idea that somehow or other we can educate people into happy cogs. As my friend Linda says, when you nationalize anything, you know how that works out. Not well ever. That's exactly correct. That's what happens. You give up your function as a parent and as a citizen when you hand over a child to what you conceive as an authority that will somehow or other reshape that child into an ideal citizen. And you don't even know what the definition of an ideal citizen actually is that they're planning to reshape your kid into. I believe with my friend Linda that it should be free market. That everybody contributes to the school if they have a kid in it. I really don't like the collectivist idea that whether you have children in the school system or not, you pay a certain tax that is automatically allocated to the schools. I don't like the idea of the state operating the education system, meaning I don't mean the state of Virginia or the state of Illinois or the individual states in our 50. I mean the state as an entity, government. Because when government educates you, government educates you with what they want you to know only. And yes, if our education system were, as Linda says, customer-based and product-based, we would have a lot clearer means of evaluating our teachers. But the point is, even if we did that, the finest education system in the world is not going to put brains into your head if you don't have them, or automatically make you use them if you don't want to. And yet our public education system and our concept of what every child should have says that, oh yeah, public schools can do that. You have to stay in them until you're 16. Okay? Because obviously, if you're under 16, you have no skills that you can use to, you know, earn money. Well, I know a lot of kids who earn money at age 8. Now, obviously, they're not operating a road grader or flying a helicopter or in the military or building skyscrapers or working on the railroads, but they do household chores and this, that, and the other. But we have a horror of the idea of children working, especially if they're, you know, working outside the home. And that's partly based on our historical perceptions of child labor as it existed in the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. And it was criminal and it was horrible. And it definitely needed to be addressed. But because we have that horror, we are making the mistake of extending our children's childhood to the point where they don't actually reach adulthood until they're about 40. And even then, it's doubtful if they can function as an adult. Because nobody is willing to accept the fact that you cannot make everybody alike. This is the fundamental disconnect in not only public education, but in the entire progressive agenda of everybody is equal. When they use the word equal, ladies and gentlemen, they do not mean on the same level under the law. They mean alike, as in that no one can have more than anyone else. No one can succeed more than anyone else. No one can be allowed to fail. And because they can't be allowed to fail, no one can be allowed to succeed either. And this whole fight over our school systems comes right back down to that misapprehension among the progressives and liberals that educate our teachers and our children in the universities and colleges. The mistaken idea that somehow or other we can create a world government, Agenda 21 again, wherein everyone lives in exactly the same sort of conditions, with exactly the same food, exactly the same comforts, exactly the same kind of success at work, exactly the same beliefs, exactly the same tolerances, exactly the same life experiences. The only way that the kind of public education system, the kind of country, the kind of world that progressives envision can come about is if you totally destroy human individuality. And this is what our public schools are doing. And it always looks like they're so crazy about individuals. Well, individualized education, you know, we've got to make it easy for this kid because it's hard for him to do this. And and he has special needs. This isn't about recognizing individuality, ladies and gentlemen. This is about doing everything they can to make individuality a burden on everyone by focusing all of the attention, all of the money, and all of the compassion on those whose behaviors and abilities need constant attention from someone outside themselves. And if you do that long enough, pretty soon people are going to say, well, wait a minute. Why do I have to keep working and keep protecting these people? They're not living a good life. Maybe Hitler was right. Maybe we should eliminate the defectives before they come to be, so they aren't a drag on the rest of us. It's a very subtle manipulation, ladies and gentlemen. Very subtle. But in the long run, which is what the Fabian socialists are all about, it will lead to the same kind of thing that happened in Germany in the 1930s. Because when we start figuring that we're all entitled to something, we're going to start assuming that why should I put forth an effort? Because he doesn't, and look what he's got. Why should I work hard and pay my mortgage to live in a nice house in a nice suburb or in the country or a really nice condo in the city when subsidized housing and people on welfare have 40-inch flat screens and state-of-the-art computers and cell phones, and I can't afford them because my mortgage is so expensive? As my friend Linda says, the horses pulling the cart sooner or later get awfully tired of doing all the work while the passengers just sit there and look at the scenery. When you focus your compassion, real compassion, on someone who needs help, in general, what you're trying to do is to make their life better for them. You are not necessarily assuming that if you help them, your life will be better. because compassion derives from agape, non-romantic love. The idea that we're all in the same boat, we're all humans, we all have the same needs, and if I see somebody who needs something that I have more of than I need, why shouldn't I give them some of what I have? And it stems from the individual heart. But when you are forced into providing for those who apparently don't provide anything at all, you get pretty sick and tired of it pretty quickly. And depending on the kind of person you are, you either sit back and say, okay, well, that's the end of that. I'm going to sit back here and I'm going to apply for Social Security disability because I've had a hysterectomy, so I am disabled reproductively, so I should be able to get it, right? And then I'll get a check every month and, you know, I won't have to work at McDonald's or behind the counter at Rite Aid or at the local garage. And our public education system is doing its best to induce our children to believe that way because it's telling them that if they're asked to work hard at something, then the teacher isn't doing it right. If it's hard, I don't have to do it. And believe me, I see it every single day in school. And I work in a pretty good school. But this attitude prevails. So when we're evaluating teachers to determine whether or not their contract should be extended or whether or not they should have retirement benefits or the idea of tenure, all this stuff, we also have to evaluate ourselves, ladies and gentlemen. And evaluate what our children see from us and what they learn from us. Because I am not saying that every teacher in a classroom is a gift of God and saintly enough to need halo polish twice a week. I can't say that of any profession. Certainly not my own. But I can say that I've seen really, really good teachers who love what they do. And who take great delight in watching that little light bulb go off over the head of a child, strongly consider leaving the profession. Because no matter how much they love what they do or how good they are at it, they are going to be blamed for things over which they have absolutely no control. No one can truly and honestly be held responsible for anything over which they do not exert control. Teachers cannot make up for or replace what a child learns at home. Teachers cannot make up for or replace what a child learns from its peers. Teachers cannot make up for or replace the genetic inheritance of skills, talents, and learning styles that the children walk in the school door with. Teachers only have control nowadays over some aspects of classroom procedure. They no longer have control over the material that is being taught and the pace at which it's being taught. They do not have control over classroom discipline, particularly if the students have an IEP or special accommodations due to behavioral disabilities. They certainly have no control over a student's home life, be it good, bad, or indifferent. They have absolutely no control over the IQ or the learning capabilities of the children. They have no control over that child's time outside of school hours. They have no control over the students or the other children with whom that child associates. They have no control over parental involvement in their child's education. My friend Rod says teachers can quit, and if enough do, they can make changes. And that applies just about everything, but people aren't willing to gamble. And it's understandable, Rod. Because, after all, we have a survival instinct. And in this particular world in which we live, survival is not knowing how to bash a deer with a rock so you can eat it. Survival is retaining your employment so that you have money coming in so that you can pay your bills. Most people who teach don't do it because they're looking for a hobby. They do it because it's their livelihood. And because, also, it's their passion. And as Rod said, and a family to feed. That's it. Most of the teachers that I work with are married and have kids and are either single mothers or have a working spouse as well. And believe me, they are not, you know, buying McMansions and driving Mercedes-Benz and, you know, wearing mink to class. They're not. Because when you've got kids, kids are expensive. They worry about all the same things every other person with children and a mate worries about. And because our society revolves around being employed in order to survive, their only real option is to try to, in spite of government, do the job they love as well as they can. And it's sad, ladies and gentlemen, that anybody has to live under that kind of oppression. Have a caller. Let's see who's on the line. Hello there. Hello.
There we are. I heard the unmute.
There we go. Me. Fine. Hi, Linda. I thought I had clicked on you hard enough, and my computer's been acting up probably like yours has lately.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, it's funny because what I was saying and what I said earlier and you were speaking on, because the poor people have to feed their families, but this, this environment we live in at this point, especially this political environment, and the socioeconomic situation, can you imagine do you realize how fast things would change if, and only if, it would be great if they did it, every single one of those teachers just said, we got the flu, we ain't coming back till this stuff stops. You know what?
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't be out of a job, Miss Terry, but maybe 24 hours, and that would be it.
You're probably right. If every single one of us who is involved in public
fire
education.
Them all.
Yep.
It would be like an airline strike at Christmas. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep,
okay.
Exactly. Because, my God, what would all the parents do? Oh, well, of course, all the daycare places would get incredibly wealthy immediately.
There would still be an uprising that you'd never, that would,
of course,
you know,
would
be like a tsunami. Yeah.
The bad part is, you know, the original purpose of unions, for example, the strike idea, was based on that, was based on the fact that, okay, if you want to continue to dig coal and make money, you can't do it unless you've got human hands to help you. And if we don't dig the coal, okay, who are you going to get to do it? Well, with digging coal, you could probably find somebody who could use a shovel. With teaching, you're going to have a big, big problem trying to find somebody who knows enough to be able to, actually add 5 + 8 and get 13 reliably, you know, it's just.
And that's why I equated it with the airlines, because not everyone on the block can fly a plane.
That's quite
you know.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So, quite true.
And it's a huge industry. See, when you hit them in the wallet, man, things change, don't they? I mean,
it does.
They get real, because the progressive, you know, when you talked about compassion, their idea of compassion and mine and Milton Friedman are like miles apart, as you can well imagine. Because when you look at it, even from a standpoint of the free market system or capitalism, to be compassionate is to be a business owner, and the byproduct is creating jobs. The whole idea of owning a company is to be a profiteer.
Exactly.
With that comes a hell of a lot of responsibility under the damn 16th Amendment, which we don't like. But, you know, and what happens is when that person is successful, whether the government takes half of it or not, it still benefits society because, man, there's going to be some other people down the street who are going to be able to pay their family's food bill because of that one innovative person in a capitalist market. But to me, that's not compassion. It's not built on greed the way that the progressives look at greed because, as Milton Friedman so eloquently schooled Phil Donahue many years ago, he says, you tell me what regime in history has not been built on greed. Do you think Mao was not built on greed? And he shut that guy up so fast, it was beautiful. I love that thing.
It's the nature of human beings to want more of whatever it is that gives them pleasure. Obviously.
Right.
Otherwise, we wouldn't keep living. We would just sort of be kind of pond scum lying there until winter and then die off. Yeah. Of course, that's
little
common.
Amoebas.
Except that they don't die off. That's the bad part. But we would all be congressmen, and that would be a hellish world to live in. But anyhow, the idea of wanting something, desire, is built in. The Buddhists believe that the only way to achieve nirvana is to eliminate desire. Well, I'm not ready for nirvana because I still have desires. There are things I want. I would like
because
to eat
you're
chocolate
still
every once in a while. Yes, I'm breathing. Yes. I would like to eat chocolate. I like my iced tea. I like to watch television.
Uh-huh.
I like to feed my kitty cats. I like to pet them. There are things that give me pleasure in my life. And I will do what I can to keep maintaining those pleasures and increase them.
And I think mark of intelligence or some semblance of intelligence is that balance that we keep. You know, whether you consider yourself a Christian, a Catholic, a Buddhist, or whatever, there has to be a balance. There are many ideologies and theologies that have balance. And, you know, to me, it's common sense. It's understanding humanity, understanding what human nature is. And that's why I believe, I think with two more days at that Constitutional Convention, they would have had it nailed. You know, I mean, we didn't get that 100% perfect, but they were so close. I'm telling you.
They came closer than any society in the history of mankind.
Ever. Absolutely.
I think of human existence as being a lot like standing on a board on which is on top of like a barrel, you know, a cylinder, and you're balancing it. You're never static because the balance is never completely perfect. You have to tilt a little each way. If we were completely balanced, we would die because we would be stagnant. But we're always seeking that balance between yin and yang, between positive and negative, trying to gauge. And when you try to eliminate that constant movement, you eliminate life itself. And this is where the progressives, their idea of this total equality crap that they come out with, which isn't equality at all, it's sameness. It's rigidly controlled sameness. It's creating the ant colony. Yeah.
The Borg.
And I don't want to be Borg. I'm sorry. I like I, not we. I. Me.
I agree with you, yes. And the whole thing was on individual. It was the sovereign individual and the private property. I'm telling you, those are the bedrocks. I mean, they're it's like the huge commandments of Christ to me, the biggies.
Well, I never would have made it in a medieval monastery either, where the pronoun I and my were my and mine were forbidden. Everything was ours. I wouldn't have made it.
Oh yeah.
You know, first 2 days, I'd have been kicked out. Of course, I couldn't have possibly been a Trappist because I couldn't shut up long enough. But anyhow, it was the way I was made. And God bless us all. Every single one of us is as beautifully unique as you can imagine. There are no two souls that are identical. There are no two lives that are identical. And the progressive's mechanistic view of everything drives me crazy.
That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
They don't see a person. They see a group.
Exactly.
And they don't divide us up into these little stupid groups, and they've been doing it for centuries.
And every time
they've been dividing and conquering for centuries.
And the same thing, even this let's get rid of tenure and of course that'll fix everything. It's that same idea that the teachers are some sort of a group and there's some sort of perfect teacher that you all have to fit into for us to allow you to continue to work. Well, the teachers that I loved the most, that I learned the most from, were not always the same. In other words, I had a miserable, nasty, revolting individual as a teacher in biology. And if I hadn't read the damn textbook, I wouldn't have learned a thing. Okay? But I had a sweet, adorable, lovable kindergarten teacher who taught me absolutely nothing, but I thought she was wonderful. You know, it's there are being a teacher, being one who tries to educate others. Every single human being is, at one time or another in their lives, more often than not every day, a teacher of some kind. We are always doing our best to help someone by giving them knowledge they didn't have. Even if it's something like, this is how you fix the whole house water filter. You know, if we know it and they don't, we're offering it to them. It's
absolutely
the nature of people. This is what people do. And the way that we offer it is going to be in our particular style or in the way that we have learned it. One of the most difficult things for classroom teachers to do is what I did for a living for 20 years, and that's individually tutor. Because when you tutor individual students, you have to adapt the way you present things to very different learning styles.
Yes.
In a classroom, you basically teach this way because you've got 25 to 30 people in there, and there is not enough time in a classroom hour to go to each one and teach individually the material in the way that that child will absorb best. And yet our teachers are told this is what they're supposed to do. And we can't do it. And if you're going
the only other way to do that is to just take two or three premises. In other words, do the visual and the audio and, other methods so that you can reach a broader group.
And that's what they've been – that's what a lot of teachers are doing with the improved technology, our smart boards and Promethean boards that we use in my school. You can pull up material from the Internet and show visually, and you can also write the problem up on the little slate thing so that the students can see what you're doing. And it's a tremendous innovation. And for many kids, this helps. I know a lot of children who learn much better if they can see something or if they can hear something. The number of people who are absolutely thrilled with and totally enjoy when I read out loud to them, books start to be fun for them. Because when I do it, I read it as if it's a dramatic reading. I change my voice for the different characters, et cetera. And they cannot, for whatever reason, allow the words to do that for them. So they're auditory learners
absolutely.
That performance. So teachers have to be performers. You know this. You are a performer.
And that's perfect because if you articulate and enunciate, the audio kids are going to get it. And if you write it on the board, the ones who like that sort of thing with their eyes and the chalk on the board thing, they're going to get it. And the ones with the hands-on, you know, and doing computers or actually writing something on the board themselves, they're going to get it. So
working with an abacus or little poker chips for counting or felt letters and numbers that they put on a backboard. You can bring all of those strategies to play, but unfortunately, you can't do all of those things at once in 55 minutes. It's just not possible.
It's pretty tough. Yeah.
And even when you have two or three additional people in there, and I've been in classrooms, I've talked about it before, when there were six adults in a classroom of 24 children, and it was chaos, utter chaos. But they had to be there because some of the kids in the classroom, it was collaborative, had IEPs that said they had to have an aide there to translate what they were hearing or write it down.
Oh, my God.
And believe me, you know, there was one particular class that I had to follow the autistic student that I had to be in. It was American history, I think. And no, I'm sorry, it was civics, and they used to teach it in seventh grade, which is a major mistake. Right. That classroom, Linda, I swear, I would come home. It was, unfortunately, the last period of the day. So no matter how great everything else was, I walk in there and the whole day goes to hell in a handbasket. And I'm sure my poor David probably thought, maybe if I just sedate her, she'll shut up. God love
her. The wine, before you sit down, the wine is in your hand or whatever.
Anything, chloroform. He did, you know, but he had so much patience, dear, and he let me live. But if anybody in that classroom actually learned anything, I would be extraordinarily surprised. And this was not the teacher's choice. They had to do this according to the regulations that the ADA, as it pertains to education, has put down. It was government that created that chaos.
They create hell for everybody because they're doing it with EPAs and every other alphabet soup. And they were talking about it on one of the talk shows this morning. I mean, it's horrendous what all these attorneys are trying to do to go up against them. Because what's happening is that what sparked it was this new EPA head now was speaking with her Bostonian accent, and the boys on the radio were just absolutely excoriating her and having a good laugh at it as well. Mm. But not laughing all the way through, because what happens is they kill jobs, they kill everything, and they're so stupid they don't even realize. It's beyond recognition, and all of this has to stop. And not just the education system, but, you know, for me, mm-hmm. you know how I feel about this. There is not one aspect of our situation and our socioeconomic governmental things that shouldn't be stricken and start over from scratch.
I tend to agree with you, my dear. I really do. And it will happen. It's progression
inevitable.
Illimitable and inevitable is gravity. Sooner or later, it will collapse under its own weight. Everything will go to purgatory for a while, and then we'll come back out and hopefully make a better system. And
every time
it gets screwed up, somehow or other, humanity survives, and we figure out, well, let's not do that again. You know, and,
right.
Except for
the Sharptons. They want to do it again.
Well, of course they do, because that's their power base. And that's the other thing that most people don't recognize. The only power I ever wanted in this world was power over myself. I've never been interested in power over anyone else other than the minor power of keeping a classroom to the point where everybody has a chance to actually hear what I'm trying to teach them. And in that case, I guess, you know, well, as you know, my classroom is considered punishment because I require order. That's part of the punishment aspect. You know, it just baffles me. But as an example, that classroom that I described a minute ago,
mm-hmm.
now, just imagine under this teacher evaluation system, that teacher, the gen ed teacher, because that classroom was chaos, she would have been, and was, as a matter of fact, rated as a very poor teacher.
Uh-huh.
And her contract was not renewed.
That's a shame.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
There were times when that particular teacher I know, when her room was dark and the door was locked, was sitting at her desk crying. I know she was.
Oh, not surprised, yeah.
Well, and
I know you're running out of time, and I'm gonna let you go, and thanks for taking my call, and it was a great
always
show,
a pleasure.
Always.
Well, thank you kindly,
thanks,
ma'am.
Honey.
Thank
okay,
you,
bye-bye.
Linda. God bless.
God bless.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was my dear friend, Ms. Linda Sills, that beautiful bird of paradise, my California conservative, and a dedicated woman who believes truly that she is this nation. People like Linda and my friends Bill and Rod and Yolanda and all the members of the Patriot Family Group, both those that were at our reunion in Indiana last month and those that come online and listen to the shows and blog and talk to their neighbors and their friends and stand up for things, these are our nation, ladies and gentlemen. The Declaration of Independence had so many gems of wisdom, but to me, the most important was the phrase that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. If we consent, ladies and gentlemen, by merely doing nothing and letting it continue, then we have created the mess we have to live in. because it is our responsibility. We do have control. We have the control of a concerned citizen who can go to the school board and attend the PTA meetings and pay attention to what goes on in our school board, our selectmen, our county government, our state government. We can watch and speak and do because we truly are this nation. We do not consent. We do not consent to what we believe to be wrong. Unless we remember that, unless we truly, viscerally feel that, then we are consenting, ladies and gentlemen, by our apathy and by our indifference and our assumption that, well, I can't do anything about it. I'm just one person. I have over and over and over again used the metaphor of the one pebble that starts an avalanche. And I use it because, being a teacher, I like metaphors. I like imagery. I like to be able to put something into words that paints a picture. Because that is my passion and my job. You can be that pebble, every single one of you. You can be the pebble that starts the avalanche. But it won't happen unless you get up, stand up, and speak out. I know that you can and that you will. Because I believe in this nation and its people. And I believe in its founding principles. And I believe in the spirit of humanity that will not lie down and be a doormat for the philosopher kings and the progressive elite. Because we know that they are wrong. And that what they wish to do is not only impossible, it is evil. Because it denies that spirit that lives in each and every one of us. That individual fingerprint on our soul made by our Creator. And we must honor that individuality by standing up and speaking out and wagering our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The only condition necessary for evil to succeed is if good men and women do nothing. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for being here tonight. I hope you'll join me again next Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another episode of Patriot Education. And meanwhile, teach and learn with joy, ladies and gentlemen, because you are the nation. Good night, everybody, and God bless.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.